Blog Talk Radio.
Running it right now?
Yep.
I didn't realize I was going to be down so many floors in the garage. That basement's pretty deep. First of all, I appreciate the opportunity to be over here at Hamlin. I haven't been here since probably the 1960s. And I first came over here in the early 1950s to play a high school basketball game. So that's how long it's been. But I'm very much aware of the campus. The subject, and hopefully we're getting the volume.
They want you to hold the mic.
Oh, hold it.
Yeah,
oh, okay.
We can't even hear you.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's way better.
First of all, like I said, appreciate being here. The subject is, you know, Black history. And I'm one of those old-timers that take the position that every month is a Black History Month as it pertains to the contribution of African Americans to this nation, if you will. But for whatever reason, politically and what other reasons, February is seen as the month to discuss the history, if you will, the trials and tribulations of the African American, of the Negro, of the blacks, and et cetera. And so in that context, we will talk in terms of a little bit about Minnesota history. The title, in fact, was A True Depiction, A True Expression, A True Reflection of Real Minnesota History. Minnesota has a reputation, of course, of being a very liberal state, and of course before that it was a very liberal territory. That sometimes is in dispute and sometimes is certainly worthy of debate. First of all, let me just say this, and I enjoy doing this, particularly in an institution of higher learning. Many people are not as familiar as they should be with respect and regard to the contribution of the sons and daughters of the Africans. First of all, let me just give you this small piece of history, that the state known as Minnesota was actually surveyed, if you will, and its boundaries set by a surveying team that had been chartered by the British government, known as the Hudson Bay Company. That one of the prime surveyors was a Afro-Canadian man by the name of Bongo. That's how his name is over the period of history and the century has come to be pronounced. He was of French extraction, if you will. His parents were born in Haiti. They migrated to Quebec. He took his education there. He already was proficient in French. He learned English. He also became a trapper, a hunter, furrier, and et cetera, and furthered his education and caught the attention of the Hudson Bay Company, who had been chartered or contracted with to begin to establish the boundaries between Canada and the United States of America, as well as territory also held by the Spanish and the Russians. People tend to forget there was a Russian presence in this country, and that was during the time of Tsarist Russia, if you will, along the West Coast. Bongo was a part of the team that came here. They began the survey, established the boundaries of what became the Minnesota-Dakota Territory, if you will. Because he was also proficient in indigenous languages, if you will, of the indigenous people, I try to stay away from talking about Native Americans, only for the reason when Christopher Columbus, and that wasn't his real name either, found it, so I find it difficult on how you could find a people who are already here. But as we all know, I assume you do, that Christopher Columbus thought he was in India. And so he just established the name for the indigenous people that were on the islands in the Caribbean as Indians, if you will. They were really not Indians, if you will. They are the indigenous people. I always like the legal references that are used in Canada, where the Canadians go to great lengths to indicate that the native people, if you will, that have a complexion and tone pretty close to mine, are the indigenous people of what is referred to as Canada. And I think that's great. Because one of the things that happens with history is that history is in the eyes of the beholder. And unfortunately, we in Black America have found out that people have a tendency to behold our existence at such a level that they marginalize it. Oh, that sounds a little bit better. Hopefully, is this better? Yes, I can even hear my own self. And so what has basically happened is that the history of a people is so marginalized and so taken away that it is difficult to feel a sense of, well, parity, really, that we all share a very rich history, very rich experiences, and et cetera, be those experiences positive and negative. And so there are a lot of expectations with respect to African American or Black history, if you will. Now, as I said at the beginning of this dissertation, if you will, there are certain assumptions about the mindset here in Minnesota, here in the Twin Cities. I've lived here since 1945, okay? And so I bring a wealth of experience, knowledge, as well as academic background, et cetera. We are not as liberal as we pretend. We are not as tolerant as we pretend, if you will. And sometimes we are not as interested in being knowledgeable about the history of others, if you will. I know as a student, a high school student here in the Twin Cities in Minneapolis, there were a lot of things that I had no knowledge of until after I had left high school. And I was much more fortunate as it pertains to experience because much of what I began to know and understand came from my grandparents. I was blessed to have two grandfathers who lived to be 92 and 96 years of age, a grandmother who lived to be 86, and so there was a lot of experience that they were able to share with me. And so over the course of time, I've been able to evaluate and assess that which I, quote-unquote, allegedly am being taught about this country and about its relationships to the African-American or the Blacks, if you will. And so I thought today I would be more general in the reflection, because sometimes when you talk to people about things that happened in the 1700s and 1800s, they say they have no interest in that or it's not anything that registers with them. And so I decided one of the items I would touch on would be sports, because everybody loves sports. You know what I mean? Everybody thinks sports is great, except Mr. Allen. I have to say, Mr. Allen is one of the few African Americans that I know that doesn't have a real passion for sports, and I have to applaud that. I mean, he's really into academia. But, you know, we are a sporting nation, if you will. We pride ourselves on being mono-mono, if you will. I guess we take that from the philosophy and the history of the Greeks and to a lesser degree the Romans. So we like sports. And so last night I saw something that was rather interesting. A gentleman by the name of Frank Wright, African-American, very well known in sports circles, particularly as an official, has on display in Richfield, if I'm not mistaken, a baseball outlay, if you will. He has a lot of symbols of Negro baseball and the rich history of Negro baseball, particularly in Minnesota. And as I reflected on his comments on Channel 9 last night, I began to think in terms of how baseball went from being a sport in which all individuals could play to a sport that became very segregated. And that's something we're not supposed to talk about. And yet, the political decision to segregate baseball after 1901 reflected another phenomenon that had taken place that same year, and that was when the last Negro / African American was allowed to serve in the Congress of the United States of America. That man's name was George Henry White. He's representative from the state of North Carolina. And that was a pivotal point in what became the demise of the African-American population, Negro population, here in the United States, particularly politically, if you will. We had just been in the Congress of the United States for 31 years. We were first allowed to become members of the Congress of the United States, the House of the People, the place where we make and legislate laws and et cetera, give people a sense of democracy and et cetera. And so in 1870, the first Negro was sworn in to the United States House of Representatives, and a year later, another quote-unquote African-American from the state of Mississippi was sworn in as a United States Senator. And we've only had like four United States Senators who've been black, and we've only had about 123 Negroes, African-Americans, and blacks who have been members of the Congress of the United States of America, and specifically the House of Representatives. And so the events of 1901 became very synonymous, if you will, with policy changes here in the United States of America. It began to dictate a very drastic change and a kind of revenge, quote unquote, for the Emancipation Proclamation, for the so-called race laws of 1863-1865, leading to, of course, the Great Compromise of 1876. And I know that's all history that many of you certainly should know. But there are patterns in practice. Your law professors here will, for those of you that are taking some form of law, will talk to you about patterns in practice, things that began to happen, patterns of conduct, and patterns of political activity, political necessity, and et cetera, and the practices that come out of that. You know, I mean, this seems almost infantile, but situations in which people are told they can't drink out of the same water faucet, they can't go to the same bathroom, you must sit a certain place on a bus, you maybe cannot even go to the same motion picture theater. If you do, you have to sit in the balcony, but I maintain that puts you closer to God. But it began to indicate a reversal in America within a 31-year period. And it was ironic that it was not until 1929 when a man by the name of Oscar DeCreese, Republican out of the South Side of Chicago, was allowed by the Republican Party to, quote-unquote, be nominated and be elected from a Negro district in on the South Side of Chicago to return, quote-unquote, to the people's house, if you will. And I'm not sure that we've ever had the kind of real reflection and discussion. I'll give you a reference, an excellent book that talks in terms of the pattern in practice. And actually, it was commissioned and printed by the Office of the House of Representatives Administration. Thick book, about, you know, 1,000 pages. But it's rich in the history of the opportunity of access after the Civil War of 1863, and then the decision to extricate, banish, exile the Negro race from representation in the Congress of the United States by 1901, George Henry White, and then to be allowed to return. Now, you have to understand, what's rather interesting, and we don't like to talk about this either, that during the period of absence, in which African Americans, Negroes, blacks were not allowed to sit in the People's House, the United States Congress, we were certainly in demand to go fight America's war. In fact, we fought a couple of America's wars. The so-called conflict involving the Spanish and Cuba, if you will, but more important, the First World War, where many black doughboys, as they were referred to, were sent to Europe to fight the Kaiser, if you will, to give their life blood in defense of democracy. And I often wondered what the great debate was. And so that was one of the reasons, as a historian, I made sure that I studied everything I could get my hands on to see the reflections, if you will, the discussions that were going on in America from the period 1902 to 1929 to justify it. Because there was also another period of time that displays the ugly side of America. And it was that period of violence and lynching and murders of African-American slaves, Negroes, many who were returning home from quote-unquote fighting for the safety and in defense of democracy here in the United States. And so one of the things that happened right here in our own state of Minnesota in 1921 was that there was a very ugly situation in a place called Duluth. And I know you folks know where that is. At that time, Duluth was a very vibrant, economically type of town. And there was real resentment about the fact that the Negro population was gainfully employed, which is more than what I can say is the situation nowadays here in the Twin Cities and throughout the state of Minnesota. I repeat that again. The Negro population of Duluth, 1920, 1921, gainfully employed, working good jobs, if you will, a part of a kind of economic resurgence in the state of Minnesota. In other enclaves like Fergus Falls, where there was a significant Negro population of over 250 Negroes working at the railroad repair shops there in Fergus Falls. Of course, Minneapolis and St. Paul, if you will. And then there was a very significant Negro population in the southwestern corner of this state, down around Marshall and Jackson and Windham and back through there. And so this resentment, this hostility started being manufactured. And the Negro population of Duluth by 1921 found themselves under siege. And as an outgrowth of an incident in which three young Negroes who worked for the circus, which happened to be in town, if you will, were charged with rape, which of course is a traditional declaration of criminal activity by black folk, you know, even today, unfortunately. And so on a Sunday, on a beautiful Sunday there, early 1921, spring of 1921, a mob, really, of over 20,000 white folks came together out in the park, drinking out a few cakes of beer, et cetera, and decided that justice would be better delivered by the rope, if you will. And so for those of you that have ever been to Duluth or have your computers and you can call up the public safety building there in Duluth, it is a massive fortress-like building. It is hard to penetrate, if you will. It's not like some, you know, Western-style wooden county courthouse, if you will, where you can just, you know, storm the doors. This is a beautiful building there in Duluth, massive, if you will, made of the granite and limestone of that part of Minnesota there around the Taconite Mine. And so this mob of over 20,000 people, well, of course, obviously, 700 or 800 who were the prime agitators, stormed the jail, and they pulled these three young Negroes out. And they beat them, they mutilated them, they hung them. Of course, they were probably already dead or at a level of unconsciousness that probably they didn't feel the last moments of their life. And it became an ugly moment because the population of Duluth as an outgrowth of the backlash decreased by almost 75%. And Negroes, African Americans, et cetera, began to flee Duluth, if you will, for the safety of the Twin Cities and other places. Now, I was taught in Minnesota public schools. I went to grade school in Minneapolis. I went to junior high school. I went to high school. And my teachers never told me about that heinous affair, that outright criminal activity in Duluth, Minnesota. And so as a young man who was very much interested in history and the truth, I began to research that. In fact, went up to Duluth a number of times, did that research. And I can remember in 1996 going up with then-Mayor Sharon Cell Belton, the first African-American and female mayor of the city of Minneapolis, who she was involved in helping to raise money for a memorial to these three young Negroes who were brutally murdered, mutilated, and etc. In fact, it took 40 years to find their graves. They were buried in unmarked graves. And I remember that particular effort. So that gave me a better understanding as an African-American about how much history is denied. I said to you at the very top of this reflection, if you will, that history is in the eyes of the beholder. And there are some things that are held and withheld during the course of history. Now, this becomes extremely important when you talk in terms of where we're at today. And there's a lot of debate that goes on, and I find it interesting. Here we are again, Black History Month, 2014. I'm not sure how many people are really interested or really care, but they should. Because politically, emotionally, these are very critical times. You know, I was not only saddened by the killing of a young black man in Florida a couple of years ago, but I was saddened by the result of the trial in Jacksonville, Florida the other day, where another young black man was gunned down. And the jury had a problem indicating premeditation, first-degree murder, et cetera. They convicted him for shooting at the car, really. I mean, let's be very candid with each other. He wasn't convicted for murdering a 17-year-old young man who was not armed and had done nothing more than being present and sitting in an automobile where the music was too loud for Mr. Dunn. And as I thought about and reflected on coming here today to Hamlin, if you will, I said, well, what is it that can be said that will really matter to those that may or may not listen, find it to be relevant, find it to be important, and et cetera? I'm not sure. I don't necessarily have the answer. I have some thoughts on that, but I don't want to offend anybody. I don't want to, quote, unquote, turn anybody off. But I think sometimes we have to look inside of ourselves. You know, I was told about this hall, this atrium here, that students come and they have a chance to chit-chat and reflect, and they have a chance to look down here inside of the great atrium and to talk amongst themselves about those things that are important. Let me share with you an observation as a 75-year-old African-American that I'm going to make to you this afternoon. We are at a very dangerous point in time in this country with respect to race relations. We're at a very dangerous point in time with respect to a comfort level with violence, retaliation, revenge, and we are at a very comfortable level with using the law, which we are all being asked to trust. Trust in the context that that law is there to provide equal consideration, equal balance, equal application, and et cetera. But some of us, particularly that came out of the civil rights movement of the 1960s and who were tutored and mentored and educated by black men and women who had been fighting the battle long before we were even thought of and were born, we have a great appreciation. I know in my 75th year of life, I have a great appreciation about the dangers that this nation faces. And one of the things that needs to be reflected by many, I'm not here to provide any kind of scare tactic or such. We're just talking about history. We're just talking about a pattern and practice, if you will. We're talking about the comfort level of one group of people to disrespect and to do wrong to another group of people. That's all we're talking about. If that's important, it's important. If it's not important, then it's not important. But if you happen to get caught up in the consequences of the importance or the lack of importance, then that's going to be your problem. And the reason that I say that is because I'm very bothered by the level of hate and hatred that I've seen emerge in this country since the election of President Barack Obama. I mean, it's nasty. It's outrageous. It is something that has never, quote-unquote, been rained down or rendered down upon any other white-sitting president, if you will. Probably the closest is the attempt now by the Republicans to talk about the personal habits of former President Bill Clinton. You have to remember, though, that as it pertains to the Monica Lewinsky situation, after it was revealed, the president's approval rating went up. So maybe people were comfortable with what happened in the pantry at the White House. I'm not sure. So that becomes a question of morality, where we are morally in this country, what things that we really believe in, and how much of a hypocrite we are as a nation, as a society, with what it is that we say we believe in. Now, what I just said to you is nothing fresh. It's nothing new. It's nothing that came, quote unquote, as a bolt out of the heavens into my mind. It is a part of what I've heard reflected by many greater people who came long before me. It has been written, it has been spoken by the sons and the daughters of the African long before this country became a republic, when this nation was still subservient to the